The mining community is really the guardians of the network. I think a lot of people think about mining and they think about how much money people make. But in reality, it is, you know, we are the guardians of the network.
Many folks in the mining space who are doing a lot of these things are so technical, or at least so deeply involved in mining, that they probably don't fully appreciate how little the average Bitcoiner knows about how all of this stuff works.
There will be these organizations, big banks, big financial institutions, and nation states that are not in mining because they're chasing the block reward.
They're not bringing further censorship resistance to the network because they're still relying on someone else who might face government demands, might for their own internal reasons or political reasons determine we're going to censor certain transactions from certain countries or what have you. Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Appreciate you tuning in. Today on the show, I've got Mr. Bob Burnett. Bob is awesome. If you do not understand mining, you need a crash course, and I think this is it. He explains how mining works, his concerns with decentralization or lack of decentralization in mining, the difference between hashers and miners. We also touch on solo mining at the end, something I think everyone needs to be doing. I think you are going to absolutely love this episode, and you're going to learn a lot. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Bob with me today. Bob, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. As I told you, I'm going down the rabbit hole on Bitcoin mining specifically. It's one of the topics I probably know the least about in Bitcoin, but I'm becoming increasingly fascinated. You seem like the guy to talk to. So I want to set the stage with, I think, really just an important fundamental question for you, and that is, what do you view as the current state of Bitcoin mining? And my sense is you have some opinions about things that need to change or need to be addressed in terms of centralization. Could you maybe just sort of lay out your thesis for where we're at and what you why you're investing so much time in this topic?
Sure. Well, that may be the whole show, by the way, because I can go on for quite a while.
Let's do it.
Just answering that question. Okay. So I think to start with, you know, what is the role of mining, you know, and kind of what are we accomplishing? And I think a way to think about mining is, you know, it is the mining community is really the guardians of the network. I think a lot of people think about mining and they think about how much money people make. But in reality, it is, you know, we are the guardians of the network. We produce the blocks, the subsidy gets released through the miners. The integrity of the chain itself is maintained by the miners. I think a lot of people have misperceptions about what it is too. And knowing that you and the audience might be a little newer to it, I think when people think of mining, they think of these machines hashing. And that's correct. And I'll say this. A lot of the companies that say they are mining companies aren't even miners. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to kind of define a couple words that are very important. And so first, you know, what is mining or what is it to be a miner? So to be a miner means that you have a node that connects to the network. And on each node, there is a mempool. So there is not a mempool for the whole world. There is, I think people think they go to like mempool.space or something like that, and they think of there as one mempool. That's not true. Every single node has its own mempool. And on that node, each individual node, as broadcasts of new transactions are occurring throughout the network, they have the choice at the node level to decide whether or not those transactions are going to be accepted into their mempool. Okay. So a real miner runs a node that does that, that says, hey, this is what I'm going to consider valid and what I want to work on. And it can be on whatever criteria they wish. And we won't go in this rabbit hole now, but for instance, things like ordinals and inscriptions and all that have created quite a bit of controversy because many people, myself included, consider that largely spam. And so my node ignores that stuff, but somebody else's may not. Okay.
Bob, is that the concept of a block template?
Well, that's where we're going next. So where we're going next is now that we have this mempool. So the mempool on your node is saying, hey, here is a group of transactions. You could think of them as pending. They mean are unconfirmed. They have not yet been included in a block. So let's just say for illustrative purposes, there's 100,000 transactions that are in that position of not being confirmed at a given point in time. Now, a miner then goes and looks at the 100,000 transactions, and they are bound by a physical limit into how big a block can be. And the technical way of describing it is it can be up to 4 million weight units, but it really that defines how many mega, it's kind of a translation of how many megabytes the size can be. And it usually works out to be about 1.5 megabytes. Okay. So the miner can then from those 100,000 pick whatever transactions they want from the 100,000 to fit inside there. And usually that means about 4,000. And they can have whatever criteria they wish to pick the 4,000 from the 100,000. Now, typically, it's in recent history, it's economically driven. Okay, which ones are offering the highest fees and they stack that. But it doesn't have to be that way. For instance, if you were a miner, you could pick all the transactions of your family and friends first that might be in the pool, that might be in the mempool, and then pick the most expensive ones. Or you could be feeling philanthropic and say, hey, there's a bunch of old ones in there. I bet those people have been waiting a long time. Let me help them out. Now, you'd be making a little bit of an economic sacrifice, but the prerogative of a miner is to make that decision, right? There's a responsibility and a power that comes with it. Now, once those transactions have been selected from the mempool, that creates the block template, right? Which includes that information plus a block header, which has all kinds of other pieces of data. For instance, a hash of the previous block and and things like that. Now, that template gets passed to the mining systems themselves. Somebody might have an S19 or a BitAx or whatever. They're going to receive that template and they start hashing. And if they find a hash of that block that meets the difficulty level, which right now is 20 leading zeros or so, then that's considered winning the block. Now, every few seconds, though, that template is getting updated. So because new transactions are coming into the mempool, and so it's not like, well, one block just got mined and now let's work on the next block. It's actually continually being updated until a new one comes in. Okay, so it's a very active process. So if as a person or an organization, you are performing essentially all of those steps, you're running a node, you're creating the template, and you're performing the hashing function, then you are mining. Okay. So if you are an organization that uses a pool, let's say like Foundry or Antpool, then what's happening is the node function and the template creation is actually being done by the pool. And you as a hasher are leasing your compute power to the pool, and they are paying you to do that. So sometimes call them mercenary hashers. So you're really not you're not on a technical basis. You're not participating in the Bitcoin network. You're not connected to the Bitcoin network. You are connected to a pool which connects to the network.
Okay.
Now you asked about the centralization. Here's part of the problem. Hopefully now people have a little better understanding of how that works. Six pools control well over 90% of the network, meaning that the block template creation is being done by just six organizations, essentially, almost every block. If we were talking 12 years ago, there would have been thousands of different block templates being created. So what we've done is we've moved, and we can talk about why, we've moved to an ecosystem that is very diverse, or from one that was very diverse and very resistant to censorship, to one that is now exposed to censorship. Because if only six organizations control all the block template creation, either they could of their own accord start censoring, or they could be forced by a government body. So that's one of the fears, and we'll kind of keep things at hopefully not too deep a technical level. So that's one of the fears that I have, is like, hey, we've kind of gone pretty radically into this environment where not enough people are creating their own block templates. So I think the question you asked me, hopefully I answered some of the questions from that question.
No, I think that's helpful. So to this point, because the threat of censorship seems very real when you've consolidated into such few entities actually doing that, the block template creation, and people, you know, host a miner with someone else, they point to a pool and they think that they're mining because they're generating some Bitcoin, each month or whatever. But they're, would it be fair to say that they're not really adding decentralization to the network by virtue of maybe they're adding decentralization in terms of applying hash rate to the network. There are different layers of the network that need decentralization. They're not bringing further censorship resistance to the network because they're still relying on someone else who might face government demands, might for their own internal reasons or political reasons determine we're going to censor certain transactions from certain countries or what have you. First of all, would that be a good way of framing it? And second, I guess my question is, have we seen any of that censorship like tangibly to this point, or is it more of a concern, as governments feel threatened by Bitcoin or what have you?
At the high level, you framed it properly. And so if you're out there and you're running a machine and you're pointing it at one of these big pools, you might be doing some net positive things, but it's not a straightforward answer. And I don't want to make anybody feel badly. That's not the point here. I just want people to understand what the situation is. So if you're out there, you have a machine, you point it at Foundry, let's say, what you've done is you've abdicated all of the power of mining to them. You're getting paid. Your hash rate is contributing to the security of the network. I think that's a true statement. However, what you've done is you've given them the power to make decisions about what goes into a template. By the way, you've also given them the power for signaling. So those of you who haven't been around, like as changes to the protocol are proposed, the signaling of those protocol changes usually comes through the block template. So if, let's say, there was a SegWit 3 or a Taproot 2, or there was some proposal out there, it would be through the blocks that we would say that the community signals that it's ready for the change. So you've given the power of potential protocol change to the pool, should also, I think, scare people a little bit, or at least concern them, right? It also means that you are trusting them to pay you. So I find this a very interesting thing, that if you, Bitcoiners are taught pretty early on, don't trust, verify, right? And we say, leave your Bitcoin on an exchange, as an example. However, the miners, the hashers, maybe these more so, the hashers, are doing that very thing. They are, as the block subsidy and the fee comes in, they're not getting paid from the block that got won. That money is going to the pool, and you're trusting the pool to pay you. Now, I don't have any evidence of any of them doing anything nefarious, so I want to be clear about that at this point. But there have been cases in the past where pools failed, they went out of business, and people didn't get paid. That has definitely happened in the past. And the possibility does exist of people not getting paid. The organization I'm part of in Ocean, we are the only pool where the hasher gets paid directly from the Coinbase transaction, meaning the pool never touches the money. Mm. Now, has anything in terms of like censorship happened? The answer is yes, it has. F2 pool especially, which is one of the big six, has had cases where they have been caught doing what I call pure censorship, which is they were using OFAC blacklists and disallowing transactions from an OFAC list from getting into blocks. Now, they've got blasted by it. And the couple times they've tried it, they've stopped. Marathon actually did that as well with Marathon Solo Mines. Marathon's also been known to do that same thing.
What's their incentive to do that? Was it just regulatory concerns if they weren't censoring particular blocks, or they were kind of testing the waters to see what their capabilities were?
That would be the speculation. They never publicly said why, but we can only speculate that they had concerns or pressure that came from an outside agency to behave in that way. Which again is, part of the concern is that these have been, I want to be clear, these have been isolated incidents to date. There's not a ton of them. They've been isolated. But it illustrates that it's possible that the threat is real. Now, a lot of people have said, even people within the industry of some prominence have said, well, don't worry about it, because if one pool starts misbehaving, we can quickly switch to another pool. The problem is, what are you going to switch to? There aren't that many pools to choose from. Now, you could switch to Ocean, and I'm not on here to be an advertisement for Ocean, because I am, I mentioned I'm on the board and I have an ownership position there. But there aren't that many that you can switch to. And what the reason, in my opinion, that we are in this position is that the bigger mining organizations in the world, especially the public mining companies, have become addicted to the payout method of the big pools. So there's two fundamentally different ways that a pool can pay somebody providing hash rate to them. The first way is that every time that pool wins a block, whatever amount of work was contributed by that hasher, they get paid that percentage of the block win. Okay. And that's historically been the way in which miners were paid. What it means is the hasher is subject to the luck of the pool. So they win some, they lose some. You have good days, you have bad days, right?
And that's Ocean's model, right?
Yes, Ocean still uses this model.
Okay.
Or if you were solo mining, you would have that same issue. Like, hey, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, right? So in my mind, those are kind of the purest forms of mining, right? Of participating in the network. The method employed by all the big pools now is called FPPS. It stands for full pay per share. What it means is that the pool is taking a lot of risk. It says if you contribute your hash rate to a given pool, let's say like Foundry, what they say is we're going to pay you every single time a block gets won, whether they win it or not. And over time, what they're saying is they'll take the risk of the variance or the volatility in the wins, and they'll provide a steady income stream for the hasher.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now they don't do it for free. There is a cost that's paid, and the cost comes in two forms. The first is they have to have a very large reserve of Bitcoin in order to do this, because they can have a run of bad luck, and given any period of time, they will. So they're doing payouts roughly every 10 minutes, whether they're winning or not. And if they have a bad streak, they have to have enough Bitcoin there to fulfill their obligation to the hashers. But the second piece is they have a formula to determine when they do make the payment, how much to pay. And what they do is they say, let's look at the previous 144 blocks, which is one day of mining, and they'll throw out the three lowest rewards and the three highest rewards and average the rest. Okay, so if Foundry is a third of the global hash rate, then they're going to pay out to their miners, to their hashers, one third of that average number. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So the problem is, if you think about it, when you throw out the three lows and you throw out the three highs, there's a lot more variance on the highs than there is on the lows.
Mm-hmm.
So they're picking up a little bit of margin of profit, okay, for doing that. But to the big companies that are, you know, in this business, they can essentially sit there at the beginning of the month in an FPPS system and know, like, if they have 10 exahashes, as an example, they can calculate mathematically within a very small tolerance exactly what the revenue is for that month.
Yeah.
It's highly appealing to them. The problem is that it's at the expense of the security of the network and the integrity of the network, that it by abdicating all this responsibility to the mining pool, they like I said, I call them mercenary hashers, and some of them might take offense to that, but it's impossible to call them a miner because they aren't mining. In fact, on a technical basis, the work that gets sent from the pool to the members of the pool doesn't even have to be Bitcoin. It could be something else. But what they have to do is get paid based on this formula, right? So even if they're doing some other work, they're still going to get paid on that formula. again, I'm not accusing anybody of doing that. I'm just saying that it isn't necessarily a Bitcoin work that's being performed.
Yeah. So it's a bit like a drug that you get addicted to, that you have the reliable payouts and, you know, perhaps you kind of throw the Bitcoin ethos aside of, you know, proper decentralization, network security, censorship resistance in the interest of, I guess, predictable profitability. Would that be a fair way of...
That's properly summarized, correct?
Okay. Is there anything that inherently unsustainable long-term about the FPPS model? Like, do you see that going away, or have they dialed it into where, to your point, like within a pretty low tolerance, they're able to figure out what the revenue is going to be for a month. And so hashers, as you're calling them, can project what their income's going to be. Philosophically, I think you and I align, and candidly, you're listening to you speak has, over many podcasts has informed my thinking on this. But is there any reason why that would go away, functionally, or is it just sort of an awareness that you think we need to bring to hashers to redirect hash rate away from these, you know, two solutions like ocean mining, or, you know, going solo, or what's sort of the way around this? Maybe is my broader question I'm after.
Well,
here.
I do think ultimately it is doomed, but it'll take a little while to get there.
And why is it doomed?
And it's doomed for a couple reasons. The first one is that right now, anybody that's a hasher and that's getting paid via FPPS is getting paid on a formula that even the formula itself doesn't vary a great deal, because 98% of the revenue comes from the subsidy. So it's my prediction, and I tend to be aggressive about this, that within the next 5 to 8 years, we'll see between a third and one half of miner revenue move to fees. Okay. Because we'll have, let's say we have two more halvings. Let's use the 8-year window. We'll have been through two more halvings. So we'll go from 3 1/8 to, what would that be? Whatever.
Yeah.
1.56 something, and then to 0.78, I think, is the numbers. Okay. So the subsidy will have fallen that much. And the historical average, by the way, of fees per block is 0.335. So even if we just use that number, 8 years from now, we'll be at 0.78 for the subsidy. And let's just say we have the historical Norman fees of 0.335. Well, that gets us to that roughly a third of the revenue is fee-based.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it's fee-based, I also think we'll see a lot of volatility in fees. Fees will not be a nice, stable thing. Therefore,
so that revenue becomes harder to model out?
It becomes very hard to model. And it's a strain on the FPPS pools, because which blocks did they win? They have to pay based on the average. But the variance in the, you know, from the mean starts getting bigger, and it starts creating a lot of issues for them. So that's one of the reasons. The second reason, and we can talk about this more, but I think there will become a realization within the greater community, even by the people who are in organizations that are just hashers, that they have given up control of the template. And that there's a lot of power and control and economic opportunity that goes with it. So if you've heard me speak before, you mentioned that, you may have heard me speak about, it's my prediction that block space will soon be thought of as a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those who haven't heard me speak before, the way to think about it is that each year the network produces about 53,000 blocks. That's what the 10-minute average results in. There's really nothing that can be done to change that. Each of those blocks is limited to 4 million weight units. We talked about that before. And that roughly translates to 3,000 to 4,000 transactions embedded within each block. So that gives us 150 to 200 million annual transactions that can be run at the base layer. Those, let's use 200 million. Those 200 million transactions must be shared by 8 billion people and 330 million companies. So that math, if you think about it, doesn't work really well, right? So if I said today I want to give some Bitcoin to every person in the world, then given those parameters, it would take me over 40 years to get Bitcoin to every person in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll reach the point where as we hyper-Bitcoinize and more people want access to Bitcoin and the base layer, that it will become very precious. So if you're a hashing organization, I think there will soon be a realization that you really want to be a mining organization and that you need to be part of the block template, because for those of you who like think about it from an agricultural perspective. So if I'm a farmer, and I have an acre of land, I can plant corn on that land, let's say in May. Now, I could just let it the whole thing ride till October, and then when I harvest, see what the market gives me. Okay. Most farmers don't do that. Most farmers start selling forwards. They start saying, hey, I'm gonna sell 20% of my expected production now at a known price. At least I'm gonna lock it in, right? And there's somebody on the other side, a bakery, a commercial food producer, that will buy that because they want the same thing. They want to lock in a known cost of corn. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is just to let somebody, I own the land. I could let somebody else lease the land from me. And so I think that would be the equivalent of FPPS, right? They can grow whatever they want and they can make whatever they want on it, but they're just going to pay me a fixed fee. Okay. That would be the FPPS model. But in another model, I now can sell forward into this natural marketplace for block space. So I'll use an example, Coinbase. Coinbase, as a user of block space, uses a tremendous amount. They're moving money, you like them or hate them, right? But they're using a lot of, they're using a lot of block space. People are moving money off of the exchange. They're moving money from one exchange to another. Coinbase itself is doing things like UTXO consolidation at a very large scale. So they're using a lot of block space. Right now, because the block space is still relatively available and relatively free, they don't have any issue just using essentially market rate at the time that they need to do these activities.
Right.
But we're not that far from a world where they're going to realize that their business can't even exist if they don't lock in block space ahead of time.
Mm.
Because if you're a Coinbase user and you even just buy some Coinbase that you're going to move, some Bitcoin that you're going to move to cold storage right after you buy it from Coinbase, if they can't relatively instantly help you move that into cold storage and it has a massive fee and it takes weeks, well, that's going to kill their business. So the reason I'm going through this is I'm trying to articulate that the miners, in a world where fees are the main source of revenue, will want to lock in a long-term view of their mining revenue, a little like the FPPS guys are trying to do now, right? But they can start selling forward this block space, and the users will want to pre-buy and guarantee access. You know, the Bitcoin network runs, if we use hotels as an example, if you look at Times Square, New Year's Eve, right? So what are the odds that on December 30th, you could fly to New York City because you want to go to the Times Square dropping of the ball, and that you'll find a cheap hotel in New York City that day? Pretty poor odds, right? Well, that's kind of the way the Bitcoin network works right now, right? We all just interface with the network at the time that we need it. And because it's been relatively free and available, we're kind of used to that. But that's a luxury, and it's kind of a dangerous luxury in that we've gotten used to this in a way that I think is going to make it hard for existing people to how can I say it? it's like a luxury being taken away from the community. I guess is another way of saying it. There's a great quote. It says, "A luxury once enjoyed becomes a necessity," and that's kind of what we have. We've had the pleasure, those of us that have been involved over the last 15, 16 years, have the luxury and the pleasure of access to the world's most secure digital network whenever we want for free. Mm-hmm. And at the point that we have a couple billion people and tens of thousands of companies interacting with the network, which is good, right? It means we've had adoption. The vision of Bitcoin is being fulfilled. Well, it's now really, really crowded. And so we aren't going to get the same white glove treatment that we got in the early days. And now is kind of, I think, that the end of the early days.
So do you think, and maybe I could be butchering a concept I thought I'd heard you talk about before, but where maybe nation states begin mining and allocating block space to probably big institutions, maybe some early adopters who have, you know, who can sufficiently pay fees. Is that sort of a longer term base case that you have who is it going to be who allocates that block space? Is it nation states? Is it the BlackRocks of the world? Is it someone else? And who are the people who are still able to afford on-chain, you know, operation?
Yeah, that's a great question. You have the concept basically right, at least my opinion, my vision of the future. So what we, if I think to grasp this, I think we need to separate ourselves from the present a little bit, and let's just fast forward 20 years. And so Bitcoin's at some major multiple in price of what it is today. We have significant pieces of the global economy running on Bitcoin now. Okay, we have nation states trading, which by the way already exists today. For instance, the Russian, one of the Russian foreign ministers or trade ministers has admitted that Russia uses Bitcoin extensively for international trade. So we know that this is already occurring. So, but let's leap forward like 20 years. Now, at that point in time, if you're a nation state or you're a big financial institution, a bank, if you have no access to block template creation, that's essentially saying you have no economic or financial sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So the example I give is pretend you are the president of a small to medium-sized nation like Bolivia, and you have, let's say, a quarter of the world's GDP. Now, if even if you, let's say you own 50,000 Bitcoin, but you have no mining, okay? And the world decides they hate you. Well, if you don't control any block templates, you're in a position where you can be completely blockaded from access to the Bitcoin network, right? You can't buy goods, you can't sell goods. You're in a really precarious position. In fact, I would say one that is equivalent to what North Korea has today relative to the fiat system. Like they are essentially blockaded. You'd find yourself in that same position. So in other words, it's like an existential threat to your country to not have access to block templates. So what I would do today, if I was the president of Bolivia, is I would be going out into the world and saying, hey, all you people with hashing power, come bring it to Bolivia. Here are tax breaks. Here are our grants, economic incentives, no capital gains tax, all these sort of incentives. Come to Bolivia and you'll be taken care of. But the caveat to all of that would be that I would also create the Bolivia pool. And I would make everybody who brought that hash rate use the Bolivia pool. And if I got, let's say, 0.25% of the world's hash rate under my control, that means that every week I would have 2 or 3 transactions that I control, 2 or 3 blocks of transactions that I control. And at that point, I would feel confident that I had secured the economic sovereignty of my nation. So it's another way of me saying, like, we hear a lot of people talk about strategic Bitcoin reserve, sovereign wealth funds, buying Bitcoin, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I'm not saying I don't disagree. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. But I think a lot of people are missing that should be secondary to securing access to the monetary network. So it's kind of that thing, right? Bitcoin is the asset Bitcoin, but there's also Bitcoin, the monetary network. And to me, as a nation, as a large bank, as a large financial institution, it's a lot more important to have control over some percentage of the monetary network than it is to own the asset.
Yeah. Does that future concern you in that, you know, so your example of Bolivia, they operate a pool and they've got 1% of the hash rate, two or three blocks a week, they get to determine what they censor or don't, you know, perhaps. Yep. Or do you view it as free market incentives would push them toward operating in such a way that, you know, that if they're censoring transactions, if they're sort of fooling around with this, other nations are going to be less inclined to trade with them. Like, does the free market sort of enable this to be a positive future? Or do you think, no, you're going to have, you know, North Korea gets 1% of the hash rate and, you know, we're going to have the West can't, you know, transact during those, you know, when those blocks are found by the North Korean pool or what have you?
It's my opinion that the world works best when money is not used as a weapon or a means of control. Mm-hmm. And so this is somewhat analogous from an economic perspective of the mutually assured destruction of the nuclear stockpile, right? You know, so yeah. I think every nation will want some level of control over it. And given enough runway, it could be centuries, given enough runway, those that don't will eventually no longer be sovereign nations. So I think it'll be fundamental to a nation state to have it. Is it a good thing? I have very mixed feelings about it. There's a part of me that doesn't like it at all. I think the thought of 100 to 200 nations all having some control over block template creation is is scary and not good. And it feels like we're going back to kind of what we're trying to get away from.
Central banking, basically, like control of money. Yeah.
However, I think there's a, you know, the phrase, you know, Bitcoin is for everybody or Bitcoin is for anybody, right? That we can't stop them, that we can't choose the participants. That's both in terms of owning the asset and control of the network. So what we have to do is, those of us that I think are more ethocentric, that want to preserve the integrity of the network, that want to make sure that we don't have censorship, that we have a voice in protocol changes, like that. That's why people need to go get a BitAx, or they have to run their own. It's not just run a node. I think we're going beyond that. Like, running a node isn't enough. And by the way, very few people do that, right? But we're getting to where, hey, we have to make sure some percentage of the hash rate power and the template creation exists outside of this, because mm-hmm. I believe it is inevitable that they will get in. To expand a little bit on that other point too, if you look at the mining community today and the economics of mining, the economics center around the block reward. So everybody's chasing their percentage of the block reward, whether that's as a miner or a hasher. I think in the future, that changes. So even outside of the nation states, if I was Citigroup, if I was Bank of America, if I was Deutsche Bank in Germany or Mitsui in Japan, I would be doing the same thing. I would be building a mining organization. Mm. And the reason I would do it is that my future value proposition to my customer base is going to be, hey, I control a certain percentage of the block templates. And so if you are big company X or high net worth individual Y, come bank with me, because as part of banking with me, I'm going to give you access to the base layer. You know, mm-hmm. if you're an American Express Gold Card member or Black member, you may get 5 base layer transactions a year for free by being an American Express Black Card member. And that might sound kind of weird today, but it might be super powerful in the future. And so what I'm saying is, there will be these organizations, big banks, big financial institutions, and nation states that are not in mining because they're chasing the block reward. They'll take it, but it's not their motivation. Their motivation is the power and control that comes with it, and the ancillary economic activity that it facilitates. So if you're Citigroup and Bank of America, and you have a big organization like Tesla, and they're going to choose one of those two as their banking partner. If one of them says, hey, you get free access to the base layer up to 100 times a month, and another one doesn't offer that, you know, that's the difference between winning one of them as a client. They don't care about the block reward. They'll give that away. You know, they'll concede that for free to get Tesla as a customer. Yeah. At least that's how I see it.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting concept, and it makes a lot of sense. So, we've talked a lot. We've got a biweekly show we do where we just sort of bat around the news, and we talk a lot about the strategic Bitcoin reserve. I mean, philosophically, our team is generally not particularly excited about it. Like, we don't want more power to the government, and prolonging, you know, another 20 or 30 years of foreign wars and all the fun things that come with government power, especially in the U.S. But it sounds to me like maybe a more likely advantageous thing for governments to consider would be figuring out how 10 years from now they own a percentage of block space effectively.
Yes.
And I want to turn our conversation now then to solo mining, because you talked about, like, you know, having a BitAx, and like what we do is we help people take 100% self-custody of their Bitcoin. We help people run nodes, like that's our Wonderful. Our bread and butter, and we're sort of moving into this space of helping people get solo mining. Mm-hmm. Which my sense, and I had like if you know Econo Alchemist, Scott 9000, the BitAx guy on the podcast recently, and I'm becoming more convinced that we need more decentralized hash rate, but also I think to your point, being a hasher and being a miner are two different things. What's the, like, what's sort of the closest thing to an easy button solution for someone who's looking at solo mining to creating their own block templates? Even if it's like a canned template that someone else provides them, but that they're the one choosing that, versus relying on F2Pool or one of the other big pools to construct that for them.
Well, so the first thing is, that essentially eliminates almost every major, it eliminates every major pool in the world. So
there's one way to getting rid of almost everyone. So remains?
So it, you know, I don't want to be an advertisement for Ocean.
Tell the story.
One, the easiest choice actually is Ocean in that case, because you may not want to run the node and the datum server and the things that are required to create your own templates. But if you join Ocean provides a choice of four templates over a pretty big range of criteria. And it discloses 100% what's in those templates. What is the criteria of those templates? So you can come in, participate in Ocean, pick one of four predefined templates made by the pool, and at least you're exercising your, you know, a certain level of that. And that's probably a good baby step into this. Even us at Ocean, we really don't want you to do that. Like, ultimately, it's a stepping stone. It shouldn't be the end state. Mm-hmm. And it could be the stepping stone for several months or even a couple of years as you bring up your technical aptitude and comfort with this. That's okay. excuse me. So I think that's the first step. Then the second step can be, you know, you've had some of the other guys on, you know, you have some choices for solo mining. There are pros and cons of different solo mining solutions. They would all be better than being part of one of the big pools. Ultimately, I think the best way to do it is to run a datum server, which is it's a free open source, I think it's soon to be open source product from Ocean. There's no fee associated with it, but basically what it does is allow you to either solo mine, or you can still be part of Ocean. Because if you solo mine with like a BitAx or even just like 1S19 or something like that, it's great. I love people that do it. God bless them. And we'll occasionally hear about a great win for people. But you should look at that as purely a contribution to the network that you're making, because your odds of winning are so remote. You know, it has to be zero. But if you wish, what Ocean does is it returns with datum to the pure sense of a pool. For me, the purpose of a pool is singular. It is to share revenue and create some risk mitigation. Like, that's the purpose of a pool. The purpose of the pool is not, it should not be for template creation, because, I mean, that is the essence of the whole thing. So the ultimate end state in my mind is you've got your hashing solution, whatever that is, whether that's a BitX or 5S21s or whatever it is you have. You have a datum server. You make your own templates. You're running your node. You're making your own templates. And then you can have your choice of either solo mining or being part of the ocean pool. To me, that's the ultimate.
Yeah. So how hard would it be for, like, if you're a average baby boomer, you're kind of new to Bitcoin, you're figuring things out, like, how hard would it be to run your own datum server, select a block template, have a BitX or, you know, whatever your hashing arrangement is, and get going? Is it like on the surface, it sounds technically complicated. Is this like something you can download on a Start 9 and spin yes. up and it's like pretty easy UI, or is it more complicated yes. than that?
Yeah, I was just this past weekend, I was in Denver at the Undermine event, and Bitcoin Mechanic, who's part of the Ocean Mechanic. Team, you know, he did a little seminar on the lunch break using that exact solution.
Okay.
Brought a Start 9. Obviously, it was already synced and all that, but, you know, then loaded the datum server into Start 9, went through, there's a kind of a GUI to it. So when you're setting up the datum server, the selections, like, you decide, you get to make the decisions about data carrier size and all these other things. That's actually the hard part. So I think over time, let me say this a different way. It is not hard. If you're already running a node and, like, you have a Start 9, it is not a difficult step to install a datum server. What might take you a little bit of time is there are dozens of selections that help create the template. And you can start with all the defaults and slowly do your research about, hey, do I want data carrier size to be 0 or 42 bytes or 83 bytes? To a lot of people, that probably doesn't mean anything right now. So, you know, you can leave the default there. And later on, you can decide for yourself where you think you fall in terms of what data carrier size should be. So the answer is, if you have a community, which you've told me, you know, you guys are working on, and I greatly applaud, that's pushing people and encouraging people to run nodes, that's wonderful. This is not a big step. It's a pretty small step.
Okay. And then this is probably a really dumb question, but is datum, if I have a BitX and I run a datum server on my Start 9, can I, is mining with through Ocean as my pool required, or is datum just effectively like allows you to do template selection, and
you
can
solo mine with datum?
Okay, so you can solo mine with datum. Okay.
Yep. And then Ocean takes nothing, by the way, in that case.
Okay.
There's no cut at all.
Very cool.
It's free. You get 100%.
Yeah. No. I love what. I love what Ocean's doing, providing some of these sorts of resources. I think is really important, because it wasn't until I heard, I think Bitcoin Mechanic, I heard, you know, a year and a half or two ago on a podcast, and had never heard of him. Ocean was newer at the time, and I didn't even understand that block templates were a thing, you know, a couple of years ago. And it's really important, and because we tout Bitcoin as censorship resistant. But it's only censorship resistant to the extent that you have the ability is someone who's applying hash rate to the network, and that it's happening in a sufficiently decentralized way to determine what transactions are allowed in your block versus relying on the big pools. So I think it's really cool. I'm trying to think if there's, I guess maybe just sort of a general question. because so I bought my Bidax and went to set it up, and like within, you know, a couple minutes, an hour, it was overheating. And so I had to go in and fiddle around with some of the settings and figure out, you know, what was going on. I think those are some of like the challenges that people, I think my general sense, and this isn't a criticism, but many folks in the mining space who are doing a lot of these things are so technical, or at least so deeply involved in mining, that they probably don't fully appreciate how little the average Bitcoiner knows about how all of this stuff works. And so the user interface and like the explanations for how to set things up and make configurations and do things is lacking. Are there any, as we think about like at the Bitcoin way, how do we bring more solo miners online? What sorts of resources, services should we be thinking about maybe to provide that handholding that people who are interested would need?
Well, you're right. It is difficult. Obviously, tutorials and things like that are very important and would help people. But that's short term. Mm-hmm. In the long term, it's imprudent on the developers of the devices themselves to create better products. And that's by the way, what, for instance, Scott 9000 does and the people at FutureBit or at these different organizations. They're trying hard. I had a chance to talk to a lot of them in Denver this last weekend. They have a huge issue. And that issue is that all of these devices are essentially being made from recycled equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have, at this moment, we don't have ASIC providers, and by ASIC, I mean the chip, that will sell to developers and sell them a chip with all the appropriate technical data. So these guys, God bless them, they're doing great work, they're doing God's work, in my opinion, but they have to desolder chips from boards. They have to test them. They have to figure out what each of the pins and the timings and the voltages and all that on every pin. And they have to do it through trial and error. And it's not the right way. So, you know, my background is in the personal computer world, and I developed personal computers for a couple decades. And when I wanted to design a new personal computer, I would go to Intel or AMD and I would say, I want to buy this chip. And they would say, wonderful. And I'd have a technical support team, a customer service team. I would get a data book that was literally a book, like 600 pages on that processor. They would notify me if they made a change on the chip. And as time was going by, they may make a revision. They would notify me of it. So it was all properly done. These guys are flying blind trying to bring these products to market, and it's sucking up a tremendous amount of their resources. So this will change, though. I'm working on a project to develop an ASIC. Block is doing an ASIC. Blockstream is doing an ASIC. Brains just showed that they have an ASIC. We need to break the Bitmain stranglehold. I'm not saying Bitmain has to go out of business, but they control 90% of the market. They don't sell their ASICs. They have very lackluster technical support and customer service. They make it very, very hard. So much like the early days of the personal computer, you're a young man, but if it was 1989 or 1991 and you got a new PC, you would feel the same way that you feel today when you get a BitX. I hope we're only one or two generations away from having much more consumer friendly devices. But I think the biggest thing is breaking the ASIC stranglehold, because at that point it allows organizations, I said, like a FutureBit or Scott's group or any of these sort of guys, to now not spend 80% of their time figuring out how to recycle. They can focus on developing
on just the development part, which is really the important part.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, hearing the process that they're going through to just for like a simple bid axe to pull all of this together is incredible. Well, Bob, I want to be respectful of your time. We're about at the top of the hour. I would love to ask you one more question though. And you probably expressed some of this, but I always ask, what is an unpopular opinion that you hold? And you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with this unpopular opinion.
Unpopular opinion. To date, the public mining companies have been a net negative to the ecosystem. And in fact, Core Scientific, in its first incarnation, it has been reborn, did damage equal to or greater than FTX or Celsius or Voyager. I think it would be important for a lot of the people in the community to step back and look at each of, if you're interested in investing in those organizations, really deciding whether or not they align with, you know, your vision and your ethos and what you want Bitcoin to be. And if they are, God bless you, wonderful, that's your prerogative. But if they don't, then ask yourself, you know, are you really living the Bitcoin ethos? Are you really adhering to the value set that we're I think most of us are trying to provide for the future. So I think that there's a possibility of some of the public miners ultimately doing some good, but to date, a lot of damage has occurred. And I don't think it's widely recognized.
Well said. I think that's a good hot take to end on. Bob, why don't you give a handoff? Where can people find you, learn more about Barefoot Ocean, and where they can follow you online?
Sure. You find me on Twitter at Boomer_BTC. You find my company, Barefoot Mining, at barefootmining.com. If you're interested in directing some hash rate toward a pool or and especially one where you can really start mining, then OceanXYZ.
Terrific. Ocean.XYZ. Bob, thank you so much for your time, man. This is such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good one.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bob. I know I sure did. I learn a lot every time I listen to him. It was an absolute pleasure to get to speak with him one-on-one. Go check out Barefoot Mining. Check out what Ocean's doing. Do yourself a favor. Go buy a BitAxe. Get solo mining. I think you're really going to learn a lot by that experience. And it's something that we are going to be helping our clients with here very soon. Also, if you enjoyed this episode, if you love the show, do me a favor, feed the algorithm, like, subscribe, comment on the video, share it with someone who you think might like it. I would really, really appreciate that. You can follow The Bitcoin Way on X. We're at @TheBitcoinWay_. You can follow me there as well, at @TheOtherMJordan. And of course, if you need help with proper 100% self-custody of your Bitcoin, which we would highly encourage, zero counterparty risk, only open source tools, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast, schedule a time with a member of our team. We'd love to chat with you. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones, Plan B residencies, everything you need for your self-sovereignty needs. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.